Today, we have another AI expert panel. I'm happy to have Sam Samain, the founder of Theosim, Seth Early, the founder of Early Information Science, and Oleg Shkoda, the founder of Oilfield Strategic Solutions. So guys, to jump in today, there's a lot happening in the realm of the creative industries with AI. I mean, they reincarnated George Carlin, and they had the one-hour comedy special where it was scary how good it was. Like, you could have sworn he was commenting on today's news. So what do you guys think of what's happening right now in the creative space of AI?
In fact, I would call it trying to impress people by injecting AI in it. But I saw that special because a lot of people were talking about it. And what I thought about it, who really did that? Who is the human who did that? Because apparently what they did is voice generated by AI, make it similar to the comedian. Also, someone improved the text, was the text generated by AI, but hey, don't fool us. Everybody is using ChatGPT and knows that it cannot be autonomous. You need to work it out to appear good. So I think that the hidden artist here is a human who was using AI. And let's say it, it's a show done by a human using AI. So I wonder who was that human and why nobody want to take credit for it. Yes, it makes a lot of noise when you say it's AI, but let's be real, guys. We know all of us, it's not pure AI. It's a big talent amplified by AI.
It's interesting in the way of industrial world, we don't have yet that threat, I believe, that we're going to have some fake personas, robots, or would you have, we call them the, in your image, that's going to be doing anything or telling you anything. So it's not, we're not there yet in the industrial world. It's a lot more, I think, prevalent in the politics and certainly in the entertainment industry, where each person carries a lot of money behind in terms of byproducts. We don't have that. The security is important. So we need to know we're talking to the right people. So I think it's more a question of security for the natural resource to be sure you're talking to the right person. But other than that, I don't see this being a massive threat in our case. A lot more entertainment, that's for sure.
Interesting. I agree with the comment that there's a human behind something. When anything truly creative, it has to have some human direction and guidance. If you look at Sora, the video creation application, someone has to give it ideas and prompts and direct the application to perform a particular task or produce a particular output. And I think what people are realizing is, yes, this is very powerful and it can provide a lot of capability, but it's really for humans. It's really tools in the toolbox. I actually had a conversation with the former head of the Motion Picture Academy, the Oscars, Andy Maltz, who is the former head of the Science and Technology Division. I had just spoken for him many years ago. And he was saying that, look, the movie studios are certainly interested in this, but we're not going to be seeing, there's a lot of issues around character likeness, but we're not going to be seeing a lot of movies that are going to be created strictly from AI. There's a lot of interesting things, but you can speed up the process of motion picture development, right? You can create storyboards and schematics and all sorts of things that much more quickly you can tell the visual story in pre-production. And that's a valuable tool for human producers, directors, writers, and other creators, set designers, and so on. So there's a lot that can be done to speed up the workflows, but ultimately behind the scenes, they're humans, and we have to look at this as a human creativity tool.
To echo what Seth said, rather than fearing AI taking over the jobs of creators, should we be looking at this as more of a tool to help get creativity flowing?
In fact, I think it's the concept of a human intelligence augmentation. We are heading toward a new era when our intelligence will be amplified by these creative tools. The same way in the Industrial Revolution, a machine amplified our capability and replaced our muscles. So this time it will touch our cognition, our capacity of thinking, but the machine will not think and will not replace us. It will just amplify what we are thinking about. Going back to tools like Sora, it's impressive right now, but just the word impressive. Is it useful? Not yet, but I'm doubting within 3-4 years, maybe 5, we'll have this tool or these engines integrating production already existing platforms. And here it will be the impact of amplifying human creativity. Because what you used to do, I don't know, you have a creator who want to create something in 3D. It takes him, I don't know, to put his imagination on a screen 3 months. Maybe with this tool, it takes him 3 hours. And that will be the real effect. So calling it AI will replace creativity is just a way to attract clicks and attention. But the reality is super tools that will augment our intelligence. And wow, I'm very optimistic for that. I like the idea of having super human, not a super AI as alone, but AI that is under the supervision and the control of human intelligence.
In case, it is still the case in the industry as well. When you come to refinery, I was working not long ago in Eastern Europe with a refinery last month, and they're looking at ways to identify specific adjustments to the protocol and the way they're producing a specific chemical. And some augmented reality and some really good algorithm AI are able to find some new ways to do things. But it's because, and I want to echo a little bit what Sam is saying, it's because there's a guy behind who programmed this who is extremely creative and he's already putting some seeds on safety. We need to look in this direction. Now, the guy doesn't have enough time to do all these looks. He doesn't have enough time to go through all these data. But guiding a proper algorithm to go and do all this churning of data, which is millions of data, of course, millions of lines, 20,000 tags that are immediately integrated in 1 second. No one can do that, but you can tell them where to look and they will find something. Surprisingly, sometimes that you didn't expect the outcome, but it's exactly the same. Again, if you don't have a good programmer or someone which is smart enough and understand the process well enough to guide this machine learning algorithm, it will produce something which will be irrelevant because the insight will be not necessarily something you want, but certainly something that's going to lead to no production or no extra production or advantage for the people. So you need the experts, you need the human intelligence behind artificial intelligence. Today, you still do. I haven't seen any artificial intelligence today that produced something that, okay, we didn't know that. It made it go very fast. It made it come to a conclusion much quicker. But it didn't really say, when ChatGPT pulls me a paragraph together, it's nicely written, it's good, 85-90%, that makes sense. But it's not something that I said, I could not have produced it if I worked hard for 20 minutes. So that's an example.
Yeah, and I think you have to think about the business problems that people are trying to solve, where you do need a business case and business justification, and then use cases, and then objectives, and then clear outcomes, and so on, versus the creative arts, where there's a business behind that, of course, but you're also looking at what can these tools be used for in the hands of the creative developers, the artists. And I also had a conversation with the president of APM Music, which is a licensor of music for commercials and movies and so on. And he was telling me a story about a young guy who had created just a very clever derivative of an existing character. And he thought that he was going to get in trouble by using this. But the director actually saw what he had done and said, oh, that's really clever. Why don't we get together? And then that kind of launched his career, right? So it's doing things that are unexpected and doing things that you couldn't do before, but it also calls out the need to think about derivative work. So when we start looking at creative works, first of all, large language models are great for starting points and starting research, doing outlines, even doing script development or whatever that might be in the motion picture industry. But in the music industry, you're starting to see generative AI create and LLMs emulate certain artists, like the famous Drake song that was made up completely, but with the style of Drake. There's a fingerprint of what Drakeness is, right? In other words, there's a genome. There's actually a music genome project that kind of breaks down music into its different components. And you can say, how does that Drakeness, how does it inform the model? And then what the model creates is going to have those characteristics. So These are all derivative works, and derivative works also need copyright permissions. Right now, it is the Wild West where the AI companies have consumed all of this content without necessarily respecting copyrights. So when people are doing things in the voice of a particular author or a particular writer or a singer or whoever it is, those are derivative works, right? And that's where we have to have some mechanism to chain together the original work and then what comes out of that work, even if it's through a trained model. So there's a lot of really interesting, thorny details that we have to look at. But from a perspective, one of the things that this guy was saying to me is AI-generated content doesn't have a heart, right? It doesn't have but I think in coming years, we're not going to be able to tell that necessarily. And it will still be the voice of the auteur. It will still be the voice of the person who is applying these tools using their creative energies and their creative thinking. So I agree that it accelerates stuff. I think that some of the directors and some of the filmmakers who were creating the Sora images and videos were saying this allowed me to do something I could never have done before. Some of them were pretty creepy, but at the same time, they were looking at this as a valuable tool.
You know, I think that moves us into the regulatory conversation around safety, copyright, regulatory, all of that. One of the things that just recently came out was the Figure One robot from OpenAI, where somebody's interacting with it and telling it to do a few tasks and, can you give me something I can eat? And on the tray, it identifies what is edible, which was an apple, and hands it to the human. So are we getting closer to artificial general intelligence? And if we are, do we need regulation and safety standards in place?
So I think myself, we are very far from AGI. I like a lot Sam Altman when he talks about AGI. He believes he will put it out in summer. I will tell him good luck with that. And I would rather do other approach where we can obtain a lot from generative AI and obtain even super intelligence level, but not with AI itself, with combining the human intelligence. Going back to regulation is very important in order to be transparent with people. We need regulations at two levels. First level, at the data level, we want to know where this large language model got its training data. It's very important to be transparent about it. And the second level is algorithmic transparency. We want to know that their algorithm is respecting certain kind of rules. Now, here comes the tricky part, because they want to be magician who will tell you, hey, voila, this is our large language model. Look what it does do. But they will tell us how it's doing that. And sometimes they're trying to trick us by, we just changed the model and this is the output. But it's not the truth. They have a generative algorithm behind it. It's just not a training algorithm. So both sides need regulations, but we need to be careful also not to over-regulate. Everybody was trying these days, playing with generative AI and see, okay, I cannot say that. This is not appropriate. And for fun, everyone can trick the AI to say it at the end. There was a lot of videos circulating the internet, how you can make ChatGPT pronounce words that in the beginning it will tell you, I cannot talk about it, it's not appropriate. So going back to regulation, it's need to be a partnership between three parts, of course. The regulators, usually they don't understand anything. The industry who is programming and preparing the large language models and the tools, but also the public need to have a say in this. They need to see, okay, I don't want the large language model to filter, I don't know, a word like male organ. I'm doing research on male organ. I want to make a drug about it. So when I'm using the large language model, it's going to be not appropriate. What's going on? I'm not trying to do anything inappropriate. I'm trying to make the large language model go and analyze papers for me about this topic. So it's a very complex but very important and topic, regulations, and it can be taken at various level. And here our roles as industrial implicated people is to give our opinion and to tell regulators, please help us, but please don't overdo it.
It's an interesting one, but it hasn't reached yet some of the industrial level, because the regulation doesn't come within the companies. Companies are regulated by themselves and they do not let this go in. There are some companies where they do not let their people, their staff to go on ChatGPT from the computer of the company. because it's intellectual property going in, because of course we don't know what ChatGPT is doing with these questions and with these answers. So if you are in an oil company and you're trying to look at some a very specific oil field or a specific resource, and you asked on ChatGPT, offshore, Indonesia, on this block, I found some oil, I want this, I want that. Boom, immediately there's a leak. Someone know on ChatGPT, who gets the data that Eni, the national company in of Italy, has found some oil in there. So that could leak out, that could be used on different things. So a lot of companies are very worried of their employees using ChatGPT because they don't know what those questions will be. It can, yes, enhance their work, but the regulation in there is that you cannot use the company computer for specific questions about your work. When it comes to the industry, it's very similar. There are some protection of IP or products, there's patents. So all these things are very, I would say, strictly regulated. So ChatGPT doesn't go past that firewall. Now, it opened, of course, those regulations opened a brand new plethora of small satellite companies that are taking ChatGPT and are installing it behind the firewall within large companies and are doing Elasticsearch. And they're doing the proper ChatGPT within the old company that doesn't go out onto the World Wide Web, but is behind this. And this is a brand new, I would say, opportunity for people that really know a specific industry, would be pharma or supply chain, to take ChatGPT and adapt it to that very specific industry, pharma or the food industry or something, and make a ChatGPT which is dedicated to this, which has been specifically implemented for specific customer. So regulation, I think, it's not yet inside of the companies. They just say, let's not look at it right now. I don't want to use it. They will come to regulate, but it's, I think, the next step.
Yeah, I think one of the things you're referring to before was retrieval augmented generation, keeping a local language model and then using it for, and then retrieving content from corporate data sources and knowledge bases, and that reduces hallucinations and also protects IP. There are some settings that you can use to control whether your content is used to train the model. Some people don't trust that yet, but it also is, you're supposed to use the API. If you use the API levels, you have more protection, but a localized model is really the best way. And as you say, you can fine tune that with your data and your content. But the bigger picture around regulatory requirements, I think there's going to be, I'm actually speaking at a regulatory conference on large language models, but the whole idea is to say, what do you need to do to keep your company from getting in trouble, right? And there's copyright issues, but there's also transparency on how you're collecting the data, ethical data collection, removing bias and making sure you don't have bias in your data, understanding what the process is that you're going to be applying the large language model to. And so all of that is going to still be, as you say, self-regulated or industry regulated, as opposed to government regulated. But when you start thinking about artificial general intelligence, I think we are a long way from that. I agree with that point. But AGI has also been defined in some cases. People say you're going to have narrow AGI. Narrow AGI is not AGI, right? So it's a contradiction in terms. So you can say it's going to get better in these narrower domains, and then maybe you'll have a combination of highly specific domains that are going to be chained together in some way. But do we need regulation on AGI? We need regulation on the data side, on transparency and privacy and personally identifiable information. And that, I think, is well in process. But I don't think we're going to see AGI for quite a while. And the human brain works in orders of magnitude greater complexity than anything we can do on silicon. We have 3 billion nerve cells, and each one can be connected to 10,000 others. And there's 100 neurotransmitters, which are all analog, right? They can all vary. They're not binary. They're analog. So there's a lot of complexity behind carry around with us in our heads. But emulating that with AGI, it's looking good in terms of what large language models can do in terms of emulation of what appears to be human intelligence, but it is still a parrot, right? It's still probabilities and mathematics.
In emulating human intelligence within the algorithms, there is the concern of bias and fairness. Because as humans, we have, of course, our opinions and our biases. So how do we build these types of algorithms and large language models and not have them be biased, have them be fair?
I think it's impossible to not to be biased in this case, because our knowledge and base knowledge as a human civilization is really biased. We have era where slavery was okay. We have era where racism was okay. I don't know. We have terrible things in our past. And pretend that we are not going to train our large language models on data on the internet is hypocrisy, because this is the biggest data set available that you can use.
And yeah. Bias from the internet, and then we can remove bias for algorithms.
Good luck with that. And also the reference, the cultural reference, like some stuff is accepted in certain cultures that is not accepted in other cultures. So here we move from bias to civilization clash. What are you going to do about it? So are you going to tell, for example, I will give a very dummy example. In India, cow is sacred. So what are you going to remove all cow reference from the U.S. internet, where we eat cows and steaks? So it does not make sense. So at the end, bias will be always here. What we need really is a human supervision. We don't need to throw the bias and the problems on the machine and algorithms and the data. We need always to have human supervision. We need to know who is the human behind the comic show you mentioned at the beginning of the episode. We need to know who is this guy, because it's easy to say it's machine bias, it's algorithmic bias, and not to attach names. But at the end of the day, we know all there's a human behind the curtain. Yes, for controlling the bias and regulation and putting things behind it. But the real approach is to put human name always behind any algorithm or any, let's call it, tool. And it doesn't need to be one person. It could be, I don't know, a team. People need to assume their responsibilities in programming such sophisticated tools. They don't need, okay, I did it, but it's magical. It can do things by itself. This is too easy to do. And by the way, this is not really new. People at the beginning of computers, they used to go and program extra system to, let's ask computer. It was not AI at that time. Let's ask the computer. And whatever happens, it's the computer mistake. But they didn't fool us. And people come again and say, no, we need responsibility. We need verification for the software. We need control to see, okay, if there is a bug, who is responsible about the bug? What's the limitation? What's the problem? I think it's appropriate to assign human to any AI tool.
And bias is, it's more complex than you think. I went to a conference and they were talking about talent retention for engineering company where I work. The problem was that they were trying to emulate diversity within the companies. And therefore, they were trying to have some blank CV. So CV with no name, because of course, let's say you are in France and you want a pure white CV. Sometimes the first name Mohammed will very clearly say that this person is from Arabic background or North African background. Of course, if you call William or if you call in US, you would be called Washington. There's a very strong likelihood that you're coming from Afro-American background. So all these things are there. So they tried to create an algorithm that was just eliminating the names from the CVs. And what they were basically looking at other factors. But the other factors were taking as well where you were located, well, where you were based and where your home was. And there was a bias that was inherent to the home there, because you could see recently, let's say you live in Houston, Texas, and you're on the east side of Houston. It's not as nice as if you live in the West Island area. So you would already have some difference in categories by knowing some people that went to this university or this one. So if you really want to remove the bias, you need to remove the names of the university you went to. You need to remove the place where you're living. You need to remove your age, or because you can, even if you don't put your age, by looking at the CV, you will say, oh, this person is above 60. Or this person is above 50. So there's already a bias. So to eliminate all bias is going to be extremely difficult. And I totally agree. We can't do that. We can't eliminate all bias, but we need to have sensible persons looking at it, looking at the algorithm and looking at the result of the algorithm and see, is there a bias or no? Or do I go through or not? In India, you're talking about the castes. I was in India and I was trying to hire people for a local company in India. And my supervisor told me, I said, that's the best CV. You can't take this. I said, why? Look at his name. He's from a caste which is above the caste of his supervisor. He will never work for this guy. And I said, it doesn't matter. The guy got 15 years of chemical engineering background. He's brilliant. His CV is tip top. It's exactly what we need. It's never going to work. So even if you want to eliminate bias in that case, you will not, because it's not going to function. So again, sometimes the bias is there for a reason as well, because it helps company to function. Because if you hire this guy, even with the best intentions in the world, it will never work. So again, that's an example, and maybe you understand that example, Sam, because you were talking about India. But yes, there is bias that exists in there, and you're never going to take this bias from the cow. Yes, remove all the cows from the streams on internet and this. No, because people have different values.
Yeah, and if you think about, I totally agree with that, because different values and different ways of thinking are biased because they're shortcuts. They're shortcuts to understanding the world. So when you say bias, what's the difference in bias, context, and perspective? Because many times if you have a particular perspective, yes, you're biased in that this is your frame of view. This is your point of view. This is your frame of reference. And what that means is you're making certain assumptions about the world. And it's like, why are stereotypes? Because they fit many times. And I know there's all sorts of political sensitivities about all that stuff, but we are sense-making machines. And by making sense of the world, we're taking shortcuts. And those shortcuts really are about judgments, and judgments are biased. And so when it comes to data and making sure your data isn't biased, it's fitness to purpose, right? It's what are we trying to use the data for? And do we find that it's influencing the results in a way that is unintended? So I think part of it is transparency. Part of it is being ethical and collection of that data. But it's also looking at what are you trying to do with the data, and what does the data contain in terms of context or perspective, right? And because those things can become bias. And completely agree with the cultural aspect, right? What is cultural bias? It's how people look at the world. It's how people think about things. And we take shortcuts because we're always processing lots of information, and we need to make judgments and take shortcuts. And that is bias.
Yeah, to have AI without bias is almost, you're not building replication of a human brain.
Yeah, I think it's hard to think about all those algorithms have to make assumptions in some way. They're looking for patterns, and within patterns, there will be some bias.
So if any of our listeners wanted to get in touch, learn more about your ventures, get your books, how could they do
that? I invite people to go to samane.com, samane.com. There is a link for my book, Singularity of Hope. The Singularity of Hope, it's all about balance. I'm putting AI in its place. It's a formidable machine, not a replacement for our brain and our human thinking. The other thing also, our tool is coming soon in Theosim, and it will be the first AI tool that would be using human augmentation as a base rather than the magic of AI.
You can find me on my website, oss-corp.net, and I usually put some of my projects in there, but otherwise on LinkedIn. I try to be active on LinkedIn. I find so many very interesting publications. And I think LinkedIn has completely changed for the last 2 years in terms of quality of what you can get and the contact with the people. So I'm always happy to meet people again, the industrial world, but it is a very fascinating place because we need to be extremely careful with AI and machine learning, because again, this is a place where it's not like the entertainment. In entertainment, yes, there can be consequences if you fake the profile of someone, if you make a deep fake, if you make yes, there are consequences, but certainly not the same consequences when you just put a refinery at a stock for 6 hours or 20 hours and it costs you $50 million. Again, we see this in a very different way, and yes, it's not for entertaining, but I still believe that AI and ML can bring an awful lot today, and we're not ready. We're not ready for it. There's still lots coming, and everybody's going to be surprised. ChatGPT-5 will be again something that everybody's excited about, and maybe it's going to be contextualization between different industries. There will be some changes. We're looking at all the new stuff coming, but again, it's very slow to adapt in our industry, much slower.
People could contact me at seth@earley.com. That's E-A-R-L-E-Y. Don't forget the E before the Y. And the website is earley.com. Again, E-A-R-L-E-Y. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. I'm just Seth Earley. So as long as you can remember how to spell the last name, you can find me, seth@earley.com or Seth Earley or earley.com. Thank you.
I want to thank our AI expert guests for coming on today, and everybody for listening to another episode of Failing to Success. If you like the show, make sure to subscribe. We'll see you next time.